Good afternoon. Sorry, I didn't know it was so loud. We're going to get started with session three of this conference. And this afternoon, we have four panelists. We have Len Hill, who is a veteran movie producer who has become a major figure in the battle to preserve an independent production sector in Hollywood. We have Dennis Swanson, and Dennis Swanson is the CEO of Viacom Television Stations Group and formerly president of ABC Sports and general manager of WLS-TV in Chicago. We have Paul Jay. Paul Jay is a documentary filmmaker and was executive producer of Canada's flagship debate show on the CBC, founder of Independent World Television, an independent nonprofit global news network seeking to begin broadcasting in 2007. And we have Roberta Baskin, executive director of the Center for Public Integrity and an investigative journalist who has worked for 2020 and now with Bill Moyers. Each of the speakers will proceed in that order. They'll speak for roughly 15 minutes, and then hopefully we'll open it up to questions and comments. So, Len?
It's appropriate that we get to begin after lunch, as John Nichols has already answered the question that we are supposed to be addressing with a resounding no. Media consolidation is a death knell for diversity. Media consolidation is not inherently good for democracy. And we come back from lunch to say that having been asserted, and I certainly do not dissent from that position, why is that and what can be done? And there's a lot that can be done. The why is that perhaps is best stated not simply by referencing the Declaration of Independence, the founding documents, the Constitution, Bill of Rights, all of which have been referred to in asserting the proposition of how important a free press is as a bedrock of society. But the question has been refined over time, and I think we should take a brief, if somewhat didactic and legalistic moment to look at how the Supreme Court helped really articulate that position. And I think the pivotal decision, often overlooked, but worth extreme attention, is the decision rendered in the Associated Press case of 1945. And there are two quotes that I'm sure are familiar to most of you, but as I have not committed them to memory, excuse me for a moment. The two pivotal moments in that case were articulated, in my opinion, in the following statements. One, that the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources is essential to the welfare of the Republic. The widest possible dissemination from diverse and antagonistic sources becomes, in the court's decision in 1945, the refinement of the broader statements embedded in the First Amendment. But the court went further because AP had claimed that it, as a press organization of national and international scope, should not be held accountable for overreach, that in fact the court lacked jurisdiction and that the First Amendment really could not give them immunity from being questioned in what was perceived of as anti-competitive behavior in the AP case. And the court rebuked AP by noting, freedom to publish is indeed guaranteed by the Constitution. But freedom to combine, to keep others from publishing, is not. Freedom of the press from governmental interference under the First Amendment does not sanction repression of the press by private interests. Those two comments, I would hope, could somehow give us a frame as we begin to unpack John's very clear, articulated answer to the question No, we cannot survive consolidation, but yes, by abiding by these articulated constitutional principles, we can return a democratic society through democratic medium. And I submit to you, there are very simple ways of doing this. Those ways lie in the application, uniform and clear, of regulatory stipulations uniformly applied that are content neutral and self-enforcing. There has, throughout the debate about deregulation, been a rhetorical presumption that regulation is cumbersome, that it involves bureaucratic oversight, that it somehow saps the energy of entrepreneurially driven entities who otherwise would go into the market and achieve unique results, that we need to take the reins off imagination, and regulation is a restraint on imagination. Bunk. Content-neutral regulation created the broadcast networks. It's a wonderful example of how regulation is necessary in any advanced society to maintain a semblance of order. If any of us could put an antenna in the sky and choose to broadcast on any frequency we chose, there would be chaos. And so the government, starting in 1934, made an election to award the license to operate any particular frequency on an exclusive basis to an applicant who was determined to be able to service the public interest, convenience, and necessity. That stipulation, which every station has signed, appeared 117 times in the authorizing legislation that led to spectrum allocation. Operate in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And so when those station licenses were first granted, applicants were told that as they were getting a regulatory benefit, they would be subject to regulatory restraint. They were being given exclusive monopoly rights, and in return, there would be certain conditions placed on their operation. Among those conditions were cross-ownership provisions, stipulations that they could not own more than one station in a given market. In fact, at that point, you could not own more than three stations nationwide. But there was a very critical stipulation, and that was that their license was not their property. They didn't pay for it. They were being loaned it to operate a common public asset, part of our unique commonwealth, to operate it in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And they would do so for 3 years. And at the end of the 3 years, there would be a license renewal process where the community in which they were licenses, and remember, these were not national licenses, each is licensed in a local market, where the community would have the right to challenge the renewal of that license and ask that the station appear in public to defend the fact that they had indeed been good custodians of a license in which they had operated in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And over time, behind the closed doors of Washington lobbyists, smoked and masked by the manipulations of large corporations, that 3-year publicly ventilated rule disappeared. And today we see billion-dollar worth stations in major markets renew their licenses every 7 years by the mere application of a rubber stamp postcard to the FCC. Now I ask you, is this a hard thing to get your mind around? Why don't we go back to the beginning? Why don't we join with John McCain, who has proposed the reenactment of the 3-year community-based evaluation of ownership responsibility? I submit to you that act alone, while some would call it re-regulation, is not in fact re-regulation at all, but merely the assertion of the original regulatory scheme that was put in place to rein in the potential for anti-competitive behavior that those who benefited from regulatory grant had the day their station licenses were awarded. And I think we can do this on a grassroots level. If you take nothing more from my rambling remarks, go home with the thought, 3 years community-based license review. It's not Republican, it's not Democrat, it's not conservative or liberal. It's Democratic. This is your media. These are your airwaves. How can you behave as owners if you allow those who've been given custodial responsibility to self-select their renewal without any scrutiny? That's typical of the kind of regulatory scheme, self-enforcing and very simple, that would benefit a democratic medium. Second suggestion, reinstate the rules that create clear, non-regulated, non-bureaucratic divisions that promote the competition that the AP case so clearly articulated. Cross-ownership is a basic pro-competitive notion. How in the world would even the most conservative person come to the conclusion that it's a good idea for the LA Times to operate KTLA? Now, the Tribune Corporation would argue there's synergy there. And I suspect most of you can look through this corporate gobbledygook of terms like synergy, which sounds so techno-hip, and understand they're just politely wrapped, multisyllabic excuses for self-dealing and job-cutting. There is no public interest in allowing the vendor of a video news service in a major urban market to own the newspaper and cross-pollinize. I believe that we have a basic problem, that the 500-channel universe, that great genie that's jumped from the bottle of technology, has not in fact created 500 voices. We should not be dissuaded from this battle by those who would argue, of course there's competition in the marketplace. There's 500 channels. That's inherently competitive. Michael Powell was fond of saying that a lot. But the reality is there may be 500 channels brought to us by these remarkable technologies, but there aren't 500 voices. There's five ventriloquists who are controlling the 500 Jerry Mahoney's who sit on the laps of these corporately consolidated, vertically and horizontally integrated dynasties that determine what you will watch and how their corporate agenda will be promoted by those issues. It is not inherently competitive, but what would be inherently competitive, and I'm a big believer in government staying out of content. Comments last night, I think, were right on about issues of censorship and $500,000 fines and those other chilling effects. Competition works if the foul lines are painted clearly and the umpires do not have a vested interest in one team or another. Let's get the foul lines painted again. Let's reinstate vigorously cross-ownership. Let's get rid of this notion that one corporation can own 40% television stations that reach 40% of the country. Let's go back to that notion of three licenses per owner. Let's talk about a fundamental concept, not only in the AP case, but just in American corporate capital, embedded in the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act, that there is something inherently anti-competitive and pernicious when the means of distribution are allowed to extract rights and condition access from those who control the means of production. There is an unholy marriage that's taken place under this deregulatory scheme that has allowed those who distribute to combine with those who produce to the exclusion of all others. It's a very simple marriage to break. We live in a wonderfully designed federalist system that's inherently suspicious of concentrated authority, that aligns legislative in antagonistic posture to executive, one would hope those days may be numbered, to judiciary. We should do the same in our capital markets. Those who control media distribution should not, as they could not under the financial interest and syndication rules, control the means of production. Simple assertion, easily accomplished, not on the agenda of the left or the right, but simply an assertion that in a democratic society, conflict of interest is a cancer that eats at our markets and erodes competition. And I ask you to use that in closing, as it were in the religion of my fathers, a corporate shema, a single unified expression of faith. Have no conflict of interest and capitalism will thrive. I'm a committed capitalist, and I came here today to urge you to restore to the markets of ideas that belief that conflict of interest is cancerous, pernicious, and should be eliminated through the uniform application of carefully crafted, content-neutral regulations. Thank you.
My name is Dennis Swanson, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Viacom Television Station Division. And let me tell you first a little bit about our division and what it is that we do, who we are and what we do. Viacom actually owns 40 broadcast television stations, not three, and all of which operate under licenses granted by the Federal Communications Commission. And these licenses are renewable every 8 years. And you've just heard an impassioned plea from Lynn, but let me assure you, as someone who goes through the license renewal phase, that it is not just a rubber stamp and something that happens automatically. People can file against our licenses, and they do, and we take the process very serious, and we make a full presentation in that regard in our license renewal process. The company's television stations are located in the 7 largest and 15 of the top 20 television markets in the U.S. The company owns 2 television stations within the same designated area in 8 major, now 9, as of circumstances a couple of weeks ago. The duopolies are in Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Boston, San Francisco, Oakland, Dallas, Fort Worth, Detroit, Miami, Pittsburgh, and now Sacramento. The stations produce news and broadcast public affairs, sports, and other programming to serve their local markets and offer CBS and UPN television network and syndicated programming. Many of the company's television stations currently operate websites which promote the station's programming and provide news, information, and entertainment, as well as other services. We did buy the CBS affiliate, KOVR-TV in Sacramento, back in December. That went through the full regulatory scrutiny, and we took operation of that station about a week and a half ago, which would give us, we owned KMAX Television in Sacramento, and that would give us our 9th duopoly. And that actually put us over the 39% cap, and we were required to divest, and we sold our UPN stations in Indianapolis and in Columbus, and that was approved by the FCC, and they were sold to Lynn Broadcasting and became under their auspices on April 1st. The company's owned and operated television stations reach approximately 39% of the U.S. television households as measured by the FCC's Television National Audience Reach Limitation, under which a VHF television station is deemed to reach 100% television households in its market, and a UHF television station is deemed to reach 50% of the television households in the market. The FCC's ownership rules limit the company's national audience to 39%. The television broadcast environment is highly competitive. The principal means of competition in broadcast television are the development and acquisition of popular programming and the development of audience interest through programming and promotion in order to sell advertising at profitable rates. Broadcast networks like CBS and UPN compete for audience, ad revenues, and programming with other broadcast networks such as ABC, Fox, NBC, the WB, independent television stations, basic cable program services, as well as other media, including satellite television, video cassettes, DVDs, print, and the Internet. I think everybody is aware that Monday Night Football left the ABC television and went to ESPN. A cable network, and I don't know that anybody would have thought that possible a few years ago. Television stations compete for programming audiences and advertising revenues with other stations and cable networks in their respective coverage areas, and in some cases with respect to programming with other station groups, and in case of advertising revenues with other local and national media. The owned and operated television station's competitive position is largely influenced by the strength of the CBS and UPN television networks, and in particular with respect to those that are CBS-affiliated stations, the viewership of the CBS television network in the time period immediately prior to the late evening news, the quality of the syndicated programs and local news programs in time periods not programmed by the network, and in some cases, the quality of the broadcast signal. The Viacom stations are equipped and staffed to provide their communities with critical emergency-related programming. Stations have invested tens of millions of dollars in acquiring ENG microwave satellite trucks, helicopters, to enable them to gather news on the scene, cover local natural and other disasters. Viacom stations have purchased and installed costly weather systems, including Doppler radar, to track and report local weather events. As an example of what these investments mean to local viewers, I think if you lived in Southern California and watched KCBS and KCAL, the duopoly we have there, they were first on and last off in the in those huge fires they had last summer. WBBM television, when the tornadoes came through Utica, would have provided the same kind of coverage. The station's weather anchor was on the air with continuous coverage for that weather emergency. The investment in news gathering and weather equipment enabled our television stations in South Florida this past fall to provide wall-to-wall coverage of the four hurricanes that threatened or struck the Miami area viewing communities. This coverage included up-to-date information about area closures, evacuation orders, live reports from local and state governments, as well as on-the-scene reports. The Viacom Miami stations own some of the most technically advanced weather reporting equipment in the area, which allows their team of meteorologists to pinpoint exact areas of weather disturbances so that they can keep their viewers informed and prepared. And I ran a television station in New York, WNBC, on 9/11, and I must say that I think the media in New York, not just the station that I was involved in, but all media in New York, did a miraculous job under very trying circumstances in that crisis. And I think most people and some harsh critics of media in the government actually acknowledged that it was the media that played a significant role in restoring calm and bringing some sense of order back to the New York area. Viacom stations are managed and operated by local teams who decide at the local level how to run and program their stations, but they do not do so in a vacuum. Rather, they decide what issues and events to cover with the input of community leaders, others in their local viewing areas. Stations meet regularly with such community members as advisory boards, partnerships, and other gatherings. And while the stations are owned by the same company that operates the CBS and UPN networks, they do not hesitate to preempt network and syndicated programming when necessary to serve their viewers. Indeed, Viacom stations preempt regular scheduled programs to air local professional and school sport games, programs, breaking news, emergency programming, local holiday celebrations, parades, and other local events. This is the philosophy under which we operate our stations in the previously mentioned 39% of the U.S. We would like to own more of our distribution system, and I think everyone is familiar with the recent actions by the FCC, which was intended to raise the limit to 45%, which the Congress ultimately rolled back to 39%. You should know that Viacom owns 2.5% of all television stations in the United States. We hear about this huge concentration of media. We own 2.5% of the stations. If you took Viacom, General Electric, Disney, and News Corp and combined all the stations that these four companies own together, it would total 7.5% of all television stations in the United States. The in-home marketplace has expanded dramatically in the last 20 years beyond broadcast television and more traditional media such as newspapers and magazines. 20 years ago, only 22.6% of American television households received basic cable. Today, more than 83% of television households subscribe to cable or satellite. In 1980, network television, that would be the traditional three, ABC, NBC, CBS, captured 90% of the primetime audience. Just two decades later, that audience has diminished to nearly a third of its former size, even though the number of networks has doubled. Today, the six major networks together, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, UPN, and the WB, capture only 35% of the primetime audience. At one time, broadcast television was the primary source of breaking news. Today, many American households also obtain breaking news from cable satellite services, including Fox, CNN, MSNBC, and the Internet, including daily newspaper websites. The FCC has maintained limits on ownership of broadcast stations over 60 years in the belief that structural regulation may be more effective than the marketplace in achieving its goals of diversity, competition, and localism. However, the modern media marketplace is far different from the media world of 60 years ago when the rules were first adopted. And I'd just like to take a look at two markets. Let's take a look at Washington, D.C., where the people that make the rules live. And if you lived in Washington, D.C. in 1960, you would have seen four full-power broadcast television stations. Today, there are 15 full-power broadcast television stations, seven low-power, 150-plus channels from cable, and 300-plus channels offered by DBS and the Internet, DVDs, VCRs, and PVRs. There were 20 full-time broadcast radio stations. Today, there are 50. If you take Burlington, Vermont, and I own property up in that area, and in 1960, so it's small market. In 1960, there were two full-power broadcast television stations up there. Today, there are 10 full-power, six low-power, plus you have the 130 cable channels, 300 satellite channels, and the Internet. There used to be 15 radio stations. Now there's 35. So you can see the playing field has widened dramatically. The impact of the Internet on the media marketplace, and more specifically the marketplace of ideas, cannot be overstated. The Internet affects every aspect of the media world, from video and audio to print media and interpersonal communications. The Internet has created a readily accessible platform for the dissemination of ideas. It's transformed one of the most important sources of viewpoint formation, interpersonal communication, by permitting individuals to communicate almost instantaneously around the world at virtually no cost. It has enhanced the usefulness of all media by allowing continually updated information to flow freely to the consumer, and perhaps more importantly, by permitting consumers to interact with the media source instantaneously, thereby empowering the media consumer. And it is a phenomenon that just continues to grow. In imposing limits on broadcast ownership that go beyond the requirements of the nation's antitrust laws, the FCC assumes that promotion of outlet diversity advances viewpoint diversity. Commission's focus, moreover, on news and public affairs programming as the sole measure of viewpoint diversity fails to account for the contribution of entertainment programming to the public debate on important issues and is constitutionally suspect. In today's media marketplace, the Commission can safely rely on antitrust laws to ensure that its policy goals are well preserved. If the Commission harbors any residential doubt as to the efficacy of competition laws, the Commission should only consider regulation which would serve as a safety net for outlet diversity. Any rule should be technology neutral and should take into account not only broadcast stations and daily newspapers, but all modern media, including the Internet, cable television, satellite, weekly newspapers, and regional magazines, each of which should receive equal weight as sources of outlet diversity. In a world where a lone Internet journalist can break a story that leads to the impeachment of the president, it makes little sense to weigh outlets based on current audience size or revenue share. Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. Now we'll hear from Paul Jay.
My name is Paul Jay. I've been the executive producer of a television show in Canada called Counterspin for the last 10 years. That's encouraging. We had one rule on that show, which made us unique, which is to be booked as a guest, you had to know what you were talking about. Which meant we didn't book politicians very often, and we didn't cover the horse race. And the only times politicians were allowed on our show is when we did what we called accountability shows, where we met, where someone from government had to come and face people who did know what they were talking about, and we had a studio audience of 40 or 50 people. If you're interested, I can talk more about the show later. But the other hat I wear is a documentary filmmaker. And one of the films I did was a film called Wrestling with Shadows, which was a story about Bret Hart and Vince McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation. I came to know some of the inner secrets of the world of wrestling, and one of them is when two wrestlers sit down, say at a restaurant and have a conversation, they have a phrase they use when they're whether you're inside or outside the business. So if you're inside the business, the conversation's called a shoot, where you talk about the reality of the business, and then the other is the theatrical side, and that's called kayfabe. So if you're in character, so if The Rock is fighting Triple H and they're at a restaurant, they can't be pals if someone from outside the business sits down. So if they're talking to each other about in a real conversation, and someone from outside the business sits down with them, they have to quickly work the word kayfabe into their conversation to alert the other person that they have to go into theatrical mode and talk as if they're in character. Well, I think that's what's happening on our news, and I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, Tim Russert had Condoleezza Rice on his news show, and three-quarters of the conversation is about, is Condi going to run for president? Now, the theater is, you can't mention that Condi Rice lied to the 9/11 commission. The theater is, you can't, of course, mention that she has an oil tanker named after her. You can't ask her, how could you sit down in August of 2001 and read a memo that says Bin Laden plans to attack the United States and not do anything? It would seem if you were going to talk to someone who might be president, you might ask something. But the theater is you don't. And there is a code there. There's a code of wrestling, and there seems to be a code of journalism. And we can talk a little bit about why that code exists. And I would suggest it has to do with the economics of journalism. One of the issues of the economics of journalism is bottom line considerations, question of costs, questions of ratings. Tim Russert can't give Condi too hard a time because she won't come back on the show. And he's worried about she might go to one of the other Sunday morning shows. And the White House has been very, very clever of playing this question of accessibility, so that no one gives them a hard time because everybody's afraid they'll lose access. The other part of bottom line considerations is the extent to which corporate ownership has made the news operation one small piece of a big conglomerate and the pressures on each piece to be a profit center. And Tom Fenton, who used to be the senior international correspondent for CBS, has a book that just came out called Bad News. And it's quite an attack on Viacom and on CBS and what that's done to newscasting. And he gives a couple of examples. In 1992, Bin Laden had agreed to be interviewed, and CBS editorial told him it's too expensive and no one cares about Bin Laden. In 8 months prior to 9/11, six or seven months prior to 9/11. He asked CBS to let him go do a big story on Afghanistan because something big and bad is brewing there. He was told nobody cares about Afghanistan. Now, let's understand that if you read Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, in George Tenet's first national security briefing to George Bush, he said there's three strategic threats to the United States. Number three was China. Number two was proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Number one was Osama bin Laden. So 7 months before 9/11, Bush is told that the number one threat to the United States is al-Qaeda and bin Laden. Now, how is it that the media can't figure that out? If George Tenet knows, Tom Fenton knew, but Fenton went back and did a study, and he found in the 3 months prior to 9/11, the words bin Laden and al-Qaeda didn't appear on a single newscast on any American television network. Now, this, remember, a few months earlier, this is the number one security threat to the United States. It's a combination of issues of bottom-line considerations. It's also an issue of that corporations have broad interests and news has a financial, fiduciary responsibility to the corporation, but there's also political and geopolitical interests, which Bob McChesney writes brilliantly about. I'm not going to go too much more into the problem because there's been a lot of discussion about it, but one example is the president of Viacom just before the last election publicly came out and said he supported George Bush. When asked why, he said because the White House policies are good for Viacom. Now, how can that not somehow affect you if you work for Viacom, if you're reporting the news? If you know your boss has said this is good for our company, I'm not saying there's direct censorship. I don't think he picks up the phone and says, make sure you do something good for Bush. But it's in the air. And then who hires the people who run the news operation? Well, they all report eventually to the president of Viacom. But I would like to spend more time on the question of what to do about it. So what I'm saying is the fundamental problem is the economics of journalism. The solution is to change the economics of journalism. And I think there are three fronts we need to fight on. One is the media reform front. And Bob McChesney's made this point about these three fronts. One is media reform. Two is criticizing existing media. And three, what I want to talk about is creating independent media. There already is some tremendous examples of independent media in print, on radio and television, Democracy Now. We're talking about building something that will ally with what exists and create a bigger platform for what exists, and that thing is called Independent World Television. The gist of how we plan to change the economics of journalism, and this idea hit me on February 15th, 2003, 15 to 20 million people around the world demonstrated against the war in Iraq. And it occurred to me, if we can harness the economic power of not just that 20 million, but the hundreds of millions of people that 20 million represented, if just a small fraction of those people would give $50 each, we can build our own television network. And that's the essence of this idea. A television network with no corporate funding, no government funding, and no commercial advertising. So I'll tell you a bit where we are, because I don't have too much time. And on our advisory committee are many people who you've seen this weekend: Amy Goodman, Bob McChesney, Linda Foley, Naomi Klein, and many others, which I can show you the list later. We're fairly far advanced. We're about a year and a half into this process. We have seed funding from the MacArthur Foundation, Ford Foundation, and the Phoebe Haas Charitable Trust. We have funding from the Canadian Auto Workers. We're building alliances with unions, both in U.S. and Canada. The idea for this network is to broadcast in all the big English-speaking countries to start with. I'm Canadian, but half of our group now is based in U.S. We have a beginnings of committee in Australia and India and the U.K. We've made a deal with Link TV in San Francisco, which gets us carriage on satellite. And the essence of this project is a marriage between the internet and television and citizen and professional journalists, and programming that will not bow to pressure. The heart of the programming will be an independent news operation that will create international news. We'll have a media criticism show that will take the big story of the day and debate whether big media got it right or wrong. We're going to have the best of citizen journalism vetted by pros. We're going to amplify all the tremendous work that already exists in print, on the internet, on radio. The one thing I think that's critically wrong with our news, it's not that they don't report things. It's not that things are completely missed. I mean, of course, many things are in terms of issues facing working people, poor people. There's many, many issues that don't get reported. But even if sometimes they do, or even on the big stories when they do, what's reported never has a sense of urgency. it's reported as it's something disconnected from our lives. It's reported in a way that you can hear the story and go watch the next sitcom. You can hear the story and go on living your life in a habitual way. There's no sense that this story impacts you or me in a way that I have to act. And what we want to do is create news that shows how it connects directly with your life so that you must do something. Because the issues of from questions of war to questions, for example, here's an example, the UN issued a report about a month ago. By the year 2025, 85 million Africans will be dead of HIV. 85 million. But if it didn't get reported on most broadcasts, and we've gone and looked, and where it does get reported, it gets reported in such a way that you never have to say to yourself, well, what am I going to do about this? How on earth can we sit back and watch 85 million people die? 85 million. Questions of, we're told there's an exploding cancer rates. Well, it's a nice little report on the health section of the news. But what will we do about it? So what we want to do with Independent World Television is create investigative reporting and debate that leads to action. And we will debate how to act. And not just from one side. We want fair debate. We want broad debate from across the political spectrum. But we don't want phony debate. We want to debate, is there an environmental problem? When we know there is. The debate, when we know there is what to do about it, not divert the attention over here. So I have 5 minutes. So I would just have one final thing to say. We need a sense of urgency, but we need to think strategically. We must act today, but in the context of building institutions that are going to last decades. We can't get hung up in 4-year election cycles, although of course we can't ignore them. We can't worry about, are we going to be, you know, in 2 years are we going to solve the problem? Just to end, let me just say how I decided to do this for the rest of my life. I was writing a film script, and I was going to write a movie called 2020. It's about a documentary filmmaker stumbling on a political conspiracy in the year 2020. And I have to decide, what does the year 2020 look like? So I start writing, and it don't look good. You know, extend today 15 years. It really doesn't look good. So I started writing, okay, well, what would it be like if we had this independent television network that was completely independently financed, that could stand up to power, that could not be pressured and so on? And boy, that's a different world. So I thought to myself, well, you don't start building that in 2019. These situations already urgent, but imagine how urgent it's going to be in 15 years when hundreds of millions of people between the various medical issues, HIV and potential flu epidemics, environmental issues. And let me just say, in the midst of all this apocalyptic sound, remember what the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy says. It says, don't panic. So I'm not suggesting we panic. What I'm suggesting is, let's work with a sense of urgency, but let's think strategically. And that's what we're trying to do to build Independent World Television, and I hope you help us.
Thank you, Paul. Now we'll hear from Roberta Baskin.
I'm the new executive director, I have to change my terminology, of the Center for Public Integrity. I've been a journalist for 26 years, an investigative reporter, starting out in Chicago, where Dennis Swanson was once my general manager. And when Bob McChesney asked me if, can freedom of the press survive media consolidation, I would say yes. And my reason for that is that the good news, and I tend to be optimistic and skeptical, but optimistic, not a pessimist. The good news is that it's so bad out there now in terms of journalism that it's good because it creates an opportunity to do something better. It's fallen apart, and I can go through, you know, sort of in a, you know, quickly encapsulate 26 years as I've watched it, you know, tragically fall apart. I've watched the firewall of commercial values and journalism values crumble, and the boardroom is now trumping the newsroom. And I sort of date myself going back to Chicago, where I had the privilege of being on the Phil Donahue show and doing stories at a time when investigative reporting, muckraking, was a joy in Chicago. People celebrated it. The news divisions threw money at it. And as I kept going, I was able to do stories that could make a difference. A lot of the stories were on health, safety, corruption, because I was in Chicago, fraud. I did a story once where I bought 7 driver's licenses by paying off public officials. And one of the really interesting things that I reflect on about that is I got about 300 phone calls from people saying, "So, that's how I got my driver's license." But what's really interesting about that is that people called. People would call up and say, "You think that's bad? Wait till you hear my story." There was a real sense of community in doing local news. And back at that time, community groups would come into the station and threaten every 3 years to challenge the license. They would say, "You know, we want to see how much you've done in the public interest. We want to." They would count the programs, and it would make the management at the stations very uncomfortable, and they would pay attention. Whether it was a serious challenge or not, it was something that was paid attention to. That doesn't happen anymore. And I had an opportunity FCC Chairman Michael Powell was speaking at the Kennedy School. I asked him, I said, "What happened to that? What happened to that interaction where community groups could demand that their local television stations serve the public interest?" And it was sort of a flippant response, but he said, "Oh, well, in 1996, when Congress passed the Telecommunications Act, they gave television stations an easy pass. Now they have an easy pass when they come up for license renewal." It's, you know, over this time, newspaper circulation has gone down. And as, you know, when CNN came on the scene, television ratings have gone down as more and more, as the eyeballs have scattered in different directions. And it's, you know, it's time for a new paradigm now. And this is something that we can celebrate. It's time to build something new. Because there has been a wall that has been already built between what journalists do and the community. I mean, they don't talk to each other anymore. In local news, I got these phone calls. I was able to keep telling a story and bring about change. I mean, there are many stories that I did. There are some stories where I testified to Congress, gave them the results of what I'd found. I did stories on drug testing that showed that 60% of the labs were getting it wrong by testing them at a time when they were going to start testing the federal workforce. I did a story on radon that led to congressional hearings also, at a time when there was only one company in America that did radon testing, and I asked the EPA, could this be a problem here in the Washington area? And they said, absolutely not. There's no reason to suspect a problem. So I tested 50 homes and found a third of them were elevated, and then tested 100,000 homes. I kept on it. In fact, Tom Shales, the Washington Post critic, said that I ran radon into the ground. Which is kind of true, but you could focus on a problem and you could get something done about it. Radon is just sort of, you know, you can shrug your shoulders about it now. It's just something, the last time I looked, there were 4,000 companies that had applied to the EPA for to be able to do testing, to get certification. At the networks, I didn't hear from people as much, and hardly ever really, and I wasn't able to follow up on my stories. I could do a story about Dow Chemical and a pesticide called Durzban and show that Dow had not reported to the EPA people who had adverse reactions, and I found, you know, more than a dozen cases, and it led to the biggest fine in the history of the EPA at that time, and Dorsban was eventually taken off the market. I was not able to follow up on that story. I just did it once, and then they just didn't want me to go back to it again because, you know, Dow was supplying these huge binders of information complaining about the story, and so it's just sort of like move on. When I was at the network, this was when I was at CBS, I had a secret professional goal to do an international story every year. And I was able to do it, but it was very challenging because it was at a time when the networks were closing down their foreign bureaus. More and more were being closed down, and I was begging to do, you know, these foreign stories and told that, you know, who cares about what's going on in other parts of the world? What we care about is what's happening in America. And I would argue that the world is getting smaller all the time and that we do need to understand each other. And I was able to do, you know, some stories that I was very proud of. One that I did was on soccer balls, about our children who are playing with soccer balls. I noticed on my daughter's team that all the soccer balls were made in Pakistan. I wondered, you know, why? And the guys in New York were saying, well, you know, what are people going to say over there, you know? I mean, everyone's going to be speaking Urdu. How are we going to understand them? Is it, we'll get it interpreted, you know, we'll have translators. And, well, you know, is that really relevant to us? Who, you know? And I was able to do the story and found child labor and bonded labor in all of the stitching workshops that I went into, including Reebok, which had a code of conduct that said that they didn't use child labor and they didn't use bonded labor. While I was looking for these children who were making soccer balls, I found children who were hunched over these grinding walls manufacturing surgical instruments. And I found one place that was where the children were making them for UNICEF, stamped right on it. And I went back to UNICEF and asked, you know, how could this be? And they said, oh, well, we heard about it, but when we went, you know, we went with a delegation and we didn't find any children making these surgical instruments. They got the Chamber of Commerce tour. That story, you know, Reebok was very upset about it, and the fax machine was running out of paper. And the executive producer of the show wanted to take out the whole Reebok section. And she was arguing about it, and I'm arguing about it, and it was time to go into the screening to look at it. And the president of CBS News was sitting there. I thought, what is he doing at my screening? This is like not ordinary procedure. And the executive producer said, well, you know, this is a great story, but there's this whole section at the back end that we need to take out on Reebok. It doesn't really belong. It doesn't work with the rest of it. And I sat there fuming while they watched the piece, and then when the lights went back on, I jumped out of my chair and said, I just have to put in my two cents that I would argue that the Reebok section of the story is the heart of the story because it's a major company that has a human rights code that advertises itself on that gives out a human rights award, and, you know, they deserve some accountability here. And, you know, we have a bonded labor, we have child labor, we have the bonded labor, you know, with the ball. And the president of CBS said, okay, that's enough. He said, I agree. He said, we're not going to buckle under all these faxes that we're getting from Reebok. And it just went the way that it was. It kind of depends on the personalities involved. But it's the personalities involved are making it more and more difficult. The last real challenge that I got into at CBS was when I did a story, and this was where my heart broke in terms of the network journalism. I was able to break the story on Nike in Vietnam and the sweatshops where women were making sneakers that we buy for $135. They were getting less than the minimum wage in Vietnam, less than $40 a month for a six-day work week. And I found many items of many times physical abuse, having their mouths taped shut for talking on the line or being forced to stand to kneel on the ground with their hands in the air for poor sewing. We came back and did the story, and of course Nike objected to it, which is, you know, you could fill a filing cabinet with letters of complaint about me. But in this particular case, it was one of those stories that resonated where on college campuses, right, in fact, down the street, they were handing out copies, transcripts of the story, and organizing picketing of Nike towns and organizing boycotts, and Nike's stock went down. I mean, it was something that I can never tell when that's when it's going to really click, but in that case, people did care about it, despite the fact that back in New York, I had been told, who cares if these women are making less than the minimum wage? You know, it's better than working in the rice fields or rice paddies. You know, this is these are better jobs. This is progress. The story was supposed to be re-aired in July, because that's what you do. You amortize the cost of an expensive story like that. And when it came time, when it was supposed to be re-aired, I was told that the president of CBS News had taken it off the schedule, the now president of CBS News, Andrew Hayward. And when I asked why, I was told that a deal had been made between Nike and CBS News for the upcoming Winter Olympics at Nagano. And when I said that I wanted to talk to Andrew about that, I was told, no, don't tell him that I told you that. You know, you can't know that. I asked for the letter that Nike had written to CBS, and I couldn't get hold of it. And I was just told to move on. Then an Ernst & Young report was leaked to me and to the New York Times that corroborated everything I found and things that I hadn't found that were worse. And I said, again, please let me do this story. We have the women, their voices, their interviews. We have the fact that they were being paid less than minimum wage, their pay stubs. And if we don't do it, the New York Times is doing it this Saturday. And they said, no, you're not doing it. Just move on. So I'm watching 48 Hours the night before the opening of the Winter Olympics, and I see my colleagues, four of them, wearing CBS jackets with big Nike logos on them. That was the deal that was made. And I wrote a memo to the president of CBS News saying that this is the, you know, we're used to seeing athletes swooshed from head to toe, but this is the first time that a network has turned its correspondents, its journalists, into billboards for a sponsor, and that it's a violation of CBS News policy, and that people would not trust us in covering sweatshop stories. You know, it was, to me, the shine was off the Tiffany network at that point. The response from the president of CBS News was that it was a breach of professional etiquette that I had written this. So I was demoted, put on the morning news, and realizing that, you know, I'd been marginalized, my producer had been taken away, I asked out of my contract finally, and he was delighted to see me go and said yes. And I went across the street to 2020 to ABC, and I went off the air. And took a huge pay cut with pleasure because I had lost respect on the other side of the block. And I hoped that in the back rooms as a senior producer in management at 2020 in charge of investigations, that I would be able to have an impact on the kinds of stories they selected. And on a good day, I could, but there were not enough good days. And if you want to know just how representative in terms of the corporate culture of these places, you know, going over to Disney, my first day on the job, I got an email from the CEO of Disney, and I thought, why is he emailing me? And I opened it up and fell off my chair. It said, "Dear fellow cast member." I was, you know, part of a Disney movie or something. I mean, it was just, you know, the journalism is just a tiny, tiny blip on the bottom line of these big companies. So I sat in the back rooms of 2020 and watched how stories are really selected. And I haven't pulled these out until just a couple of weeks ago. This is from 5 years ago. These are minute-by-minute ratings where these very scared executives who are losing more and more people are moving to other places to get their news. This is this shows that minute-by-minute, okay, Macaulay Culkin, an interview that everybody wants to see that, it goes up. Then it goes way down over here, some interesting ideas on the presidential election counting process, and it just plummets. There's another one here that is a whole show on porn, and the ratings stay very high throughout that show. This is how they're making decisions. They're sitting there hanging by their fingernails thinking, how can we keep people from hitting the remote control device and going somewhere else? And when you start to think like that, when you're thinking about how do I keep how do I keep people entertained? How do I keep them entertained instead of how do I tell them what they need to know? That it might as well be under the entertainment division. So I worked, my next move was with Bill Moyers, now with Bill Moyers, where I was able to do stories on influence peddling in Washington, which was, it was a wonderful year-long journey under a grant. At the end of that time, I'm thinking about, what can I do in this journalism, in journalism that has really crumbled, that's not serving the public interest anymore. And the Center for Public Integrity has been around for 15 years. It's investigative reporters, about 30 of them, who in a not-for-profit setting, nonpartisan, do hard-hitting, no stone unturned investigative reporting in the public interest. These are the stories that the networks and the newspapers aren't doing anymore because the first thing that they cut is investigative reporting. It's the first place that goes. And we supply information to the New York Times, Washington Post, WLS in Chicago, whoever wants it. We've done a number of investigations that have at our website, which I invite you to go to. It's www.publicintegrity.org. There are stories on media consolidation. John Dunbar did this media tracker where you can punch in your zip code and see who owns, what media in your particular zip code. Done private military service, the buying of the president, 2004, that book, war profiteering, the no-bid defense contracts. And most recently, and this was the first story that I did, was we call it Lobby Watch. And it's taking a look at lobbying in Washington, which you could say is the fourth branch of government. We've all spent a lot of time doing campaign finance, 10 times more stories than there are on lobbying. But $13 billion has been spent on lobbying in the last 6 years. It's twice as much as has been spent on campaign finance. It's a huge industry. There's 21,000 companies that are employing lobbyists. And what we found is that 49 out of the top 50 lobbying firms in Washington don't even bother to file federal disclosure forms that they're required to file. There's only 11 people at the Senate Office of Public Records who, there's just no enforcement. And back in when the Lobbying Disclosure Act was first passed back in 1995, the Federal Elections Commission, which has almost 300 people, wanted to have it under their purview because they had enforcement powers. But Congress kept it under their own roof where nobody pays attention to it. And the result is, and I think maybe it's because it's kind of like a pension plan for congressmen, because many of them end up working as lobbyists when they graduate from the Hill. It's underreported. I would say it's really unreported. And we also found 14,000 documents that were missing at the Senate Office of Public Records. That story, we put it out, and it went out to more than 100 newspapers. The New York Times did an editorial. The Christian Science Monitor did an editorial. Lee Hamilton wrote the former co-chair of the 9/11 Commission wrote an op-ed. And last week, legislation was sponsored on the Hill to do something about it. To me, it's a fascinating way of looking at this new paradigm of how we can intersect not just with journalists, which is what we've done in the past, but also with the public, putting information out in a direct way. I want to make the Center for Public Integrity's website, in a sense, a channel, and not just pushing information out, but bringing people in. I'm fascinated by community journalism right now. I think that the more voices, the better it is for democracy. And it's almost going full circle for me. I'm thinking about it like being back in local news. And instead of being at the network where there's this kind of, you're isolated, you're in this ivory tower, and there's this arrogance factor and people don't talk to you, there's this opportunity to sort of get back into local news where you talk to people and they talk back to you, and give them space on the website to talk to each other. We're also working on something to do a real-time investigation where instead of waiting and putting out a book like the buying of the president, instead to show people as we're doing the investigation, the Freedom of Information Act requests, all of that. And so I just want to say that my last words are, I am not discouraged. The bad news is that it's so bad that it is good news, and that we all have an opportunity to build something better and to build something that involves all of the voices that are in this room and that are out there, and take journalism, you know, back to almost sort of a local accountability, and I think that, you know, I think it can be a really good thing. Thanks.
Thank you, Roberta. At this point, I'd like to introduce myself, because I forgot to. I'm Angarad Valdivia, here from the University of Illinois, and we're going to open up the mics for people to either ask questions or make comments to the panel, and I'd like to thank the panel for largely sticking to their 15-minute limits. Thank you. Okay. John, do you want to start? Why don't you go first?
Hi, my name's John Anderson. I work with Free Press. I produce a radio show called Media Minutes, and I've been taping a lot of the stuff here. Thank you. Someone's actually heard it. Woo! I have just a couple of comments and some questions for Dennis Swanson. I really respect the fact that you've actually come to sit at this table. I'd really also like to think that one of the reasons why you're sitting at this table is because there's actually people mobilized to come and hear what you have to say, and that's because they're engaged in issues of media policy and media policy reform, which leads me to my comment and my two questions. The first one is, please, I mean, if we're going to respect you, please respect us and don't come in regurgitating the same lobbying factoidal inaccuracies that we heard in 2003 during the media ownership rules revisions, like the reach versus raw numbers. We only own 2% of the stations, but they reach 39.6% of the national audience, which means that someone else's 2% of the stations might be reaching less of an audience, which makes their stations less effective, less likely to change public opinion, less likely to reach a maximum audience and get advertisers. The second one is dealing with your radio brethren in Chicago. I used to work in the commercial radio industry, and my dream job was to work at WMAQ, which was kind of an irreverent news station, which was bought by Infinity, who owns WBBM, who killed off WMAQ and replaced it with a sports talk format station. And that was kind of one of the major impetuses to get me to leave the industry and start taking up kind of the radical activist cause. And now the two questions. One of them deals with your statistic about you only reach 39% of the audience, and that's because VHF and UHF stations are counted differently. Even though we all know that the majority of people receive their television signals now by cable, which pretty much nullifies the VHF versus UHF distinction. Yet, you talk about how there's all this wonderful stuff that's happened in the last 60 years, and the rules are a lot different now, so we need to get rid of these 60-year-old rules and start adapting to the common technology. And I just don't understand how you can say, let's advocate to keep years-old rules in one point, and then say, let's not, because progress is moving on. I was just wondering if possibly you could address that first.
Well, I'm not sure what the question, I missed the point of your question.
Okay, the point of the question is that you calculate your audience, the reach of your audience based on...
No, I don't calculate it. It's a formula, right. The FCC, we're at 39%. I didn't make up the 150.
Yes, I know.
The Congress did.
Okay. I guess we can just move on past that one because we're not here to kind of debate minutia, but I think most of the people in the audience can see my point here. The second one is I wanted to know how your if you guys ever filed that business insurance interruption claim. This was something that was reported in the trade press about 3 months after September 11th. Talked about Viacom was possibly going to file a claim for business interruption insurance revenues based on the lack of revenues that were generated due to the lack of advertising in the immediate aftermath post 9/11, I actually believe that there was actually an estimate on potential revenue loss somewhere estimated between $200 and $400 million, and I was just wondering if you guys actually filed that claim and recouped any money.
Well, I can't speak for Viacom because I didn't work for Viacom at the time. I worked for NBC at the time, and I do believe that GE did file for insurance claims, and I couldn't tell you what the amount of that was, but I do believe that there was a filing on behalf of GE. I couldn't comment on Viacom. As I say, I didn't work for them at the time.
Okay, thanks.
Now we'll go to that. Mike?
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! I was just wondering if, if Dennis Swanson could respond to Roberta Baskin's experience at CBS on the Nike story.
Well, Roberta worked for me, and I have a high regard for her. And if she says that happened, I have no reason to dispute it. On the other hand, Andrew's not here to tell his side of the story. I have nothing to do with CBS News. I don't work for them, and I didn't work for them then, and I worked across the street at NBC at the time, so it's hard for me to give you an intelligent. I'm not trying to duck the question. It's just if you want to ask me something.
Well, your thoughts on the reporters, and then ultimately the sports reporters.
Well, I will tell you what you know. I'll tell you what the policies are in the Viacom television stations division, which I do have some control over. And there was a recent recall by Ford Motor Company, and those were stories that were broken in our division. The lead story out of that was broken by WCBS in New York, and it ran throughout our division. Ultimately, Ford Motor Company wasn't thrilled with it, obviously, and it cost us some advertising. But ultimately, Ford Motor Company had to come to grips with the fact that they had a problem, and subsequently the recall occurred. We deal with stories of this nature all the time. And this is, when I started in this business, one of the reasons I came back to Champaign today, I have 2 degrees from this university, the people like Harry Scornia and Frank Schooley and John Rignell and some of these people taught me about community involvement, community service, and good news. So it's something that I've tried to practice throughout my now 46 years in the business. Also came back because I was basketball manager for 4 years and came back for the anniversary date in January when we whipped up on Minnesota. And so this university is part of my life. I don't know, most of you wouldn't know, I serve on the foundation board for this university, and you should know I'm on the development committee, and you can figure out what that means. But on the
issue of the Nike swoosh, do you approve of the sportscasters wearing it?
I think if they had it on, I would find that regrettable. I don't think that should be a practice. It's certainly not a practice in our division. And I don't know who the four were that Roberta was making reference to. I don't know if they were in the sports division, the news division, or who they were.
Actually, they were 48 hours news journalists.
Then that would be regrettable.
One of the darkest things that is not talked about very much in journalism right now is self-censorship. More and more is being asked of journalists. News divisions are shrinking. There's fewer reporters to do more work. I wonder, having been my boss back in the Chicago days of where investigative reporting was taken so seriously both by the television station and the public, and to the sort of sad situation that we're in now, I wonder, if you could just reflect on what you've seen.
Well, I'd like to think, and I use the Ford Motor Company story as an example, there are others, that we would still practice investigative reporting. In fairness to CBS News, and it was 60 Minutes that broke the Abu Dhabi story, so I don't think they shy away from investigative stories. And this will be a disappointment to you, Roberta, but I've been driving down here from Chicago this morning, and Macaulay Culkin was the lead story today because he testified on behalf of Michael Jackson.
That's a perfect story. I will add one very sad thing, and that is when 2020 came and closed down the Washington magazines, 2020 Prime Times. The exact line from the executive producer who flew down from New York was, "We don't want Washington stories anymore. From now on, we're going to do, quote, personalities, pop culture, and big gets."
The one thing, news. Roberta, that I would agree with you on, it would be a concern of mine, and I've actually talked to Av Weston about it, because he serves as one of the news people associated with the National Television Academy. And this is my term as chairman, and we've talked about it. Is the overall quality or the state of journalism? And I wonder if this isn't true of the entire television industry, but it's expanded so fast. I know you don't want to accept the facts that if we regurgitated them from 2003, so be it. The fact of the matter is the media platforms have so exploded, and there are so many people. I think one of the problems in primetime television now is, Len may want to comment on this. I don't know how many writers, producers, that in Hollywood can crank out, not 10, 15 sitcoms, but 40 or 50 a year. And I think the same thing is true in the news business. And I would hope this university, with its proud tradition in the College of Communications, is turning out qualified journalists. But I wonder if, when I was a kid and a reporter, you had to have two not linked sources before you went with a story. Now, people publish rumors, and they ask you to comment on a rumor. The standards have changed.
Do you think Roberta was right to write that memo?
Do I think Roberta was right? You're asking me to comment on a circumstance that I know virtually nothing about and was in a different company. And until I saw the memo, until I talked to people on both sides, it would be hard for me to comment publicly on that specific incident. Okay?
There was a press release put out by CBS in which Andrew did say that it was a breach of professional ethics, did this, which, it was a struggle because I knew that my life would be over at CBS when I did it, but I have to say I slept better after I did it.
If you want to get in and probe CBS News, then you should have invited somebody from CBS News who would be familiar with these circumstances and the memos and the releases that were put out, who could more intelligently comment on it. I'm glad to comment on things that I am directly involved in or know something about firsthand, and I'll give you overall generic observation, but to comment on the specifics of these incidents is a little bit awkward given you're asking me about things that I'm learning for the first time today myself.
I think we'll move on to the next person that's been waiting here very patiently.
Hi. I would like to raise an issue with Mr. Hill, who is such an ardent believer in the dead horse of capitalism, even as its putrid situation at this time, which has turned all the representations of human activity, either intellectual or material, in commodified into this time, and he wants to win a race for him. If you remember, the God's land at first was private material, and the rulers as a reward for the services rendered or are perceived to be rendered in the future, they distributed amongst their vassals and their lackeys and their subordinates. So the land became a private property. So was the water. The water was God's creation and it was available to everybody. So some people came in and the rulers, they fought and they had armies and they controlled the sources of water and made it privatized. Now you're talking about the airwaves. Airwaves, you know, are just part of the air. If they could have privatized the whole air, they would have privatized it. They haven't got the means, the technology to do. What they have is the airwaves. The airwaves, they give it to their, you know, oligopoly or monopoly. I mean, even if it's an oligopoly or if it's a polypoly, if they say the same thing for the rulers, they're going to say the same thing because they have the control, they have the power, and they have the possibility to reward it and award it to anybody who is promised to play the game and render services for them. So why do you expect this thing to? Why do you think this is an exception to everything else, and you expect it to do something else? Of course, they're going to do this, you know. So I would say that keep believing in this capitalist thing until they privatize your air that you breathe too.
Is that a question?
Yes. Yeah, why does it think that this should be, the airwaves should be an exception to the other things that are privatized by the powers that be? That's a very valid question. Yes, that's a question.
Thank you.
I hope I can clarify my remarks without doing an entire discourse on the moral legitimacy of corporate capitalism. I believe that the airwaves in this country belong to the people, and I don't think there's a person in this room, including Dennis, who would dispute that. And that we, through our government, determine what will serve the common interest in awarding spectrum or other exclusivities that are technologically required in order to maximize the utility of that public resource. It is simply my contention at this point that the original spectrum allocation on which all of those Viacom stations are dependent are still in place, but they have effectively been loosened of any of the regulatory restraints that the public originally served as a tax on those regulatory grants. So they now have all the beef and none of the bill. That there's a problem here when they were not purchasing these assets but were being given the assets to act in public trust. And I think it's completely consistent with the notion of fundamental commonwealth in a democratic society that our custodians, elected officials, have entered a pact that we now ask those who are the beneficiaries of regulatory grant to accept regulatory restraint. The sad fact is that we've allowed our representatives to effectively been purchased by big media. They don't debate these issues in public. The 1996 Telecommunications Act was an abomination. And that's why I believe we have to start over again, and to quote my favorite movie of all time, remember those things that were prophetically envisioned by Paddy Chayefsky. If there's a point in these conferences, it's that we might, through the exchange of information, go to a window, stick our fist out, and begin to yell, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. The airwaves belong to us." And until we begin to believe that and assert that it is our commonwealth, it isn't private property, we're going to get this corporate agenda in the place of public good. At the same point, I want to suggest that we be suspicious of those who would say that independent broadcasting and fractional narrowcasting is a good way to relieve our anxiety, because I believe in the democratic process. And I believe the democratic process should not be vented on the margins by fractional narrowcasting. I love, to quote another Canadian, the concept of a tribal fire, of broadcasting as a way of bringing us together as a community. I believe passionately in localism. I don't believe in fractionalism. So I really hope that we can rescue the airwaves in support of localism and democracy to light the tribal fire and fully till our public lands to the public benefit.
Add to that. One of the things that you need in democracy is for the journalists to shed a bright light on what's going on out there. And in the case of the media consolidation rules that were being voted on the Hill in Congress, I was covering it for Now with Bill Moyers, and there were 75 general managers from across the country who were there, crowded into the Appropriations Committee room to see what was going to happen, and there were lobbyists there. We were the only camera in the room, and there's something wrong with that picture, and you have 75 general managers who think it's important enough to come in from all over America, but no camera to tell people what's going on.
Thank you. We'll move to that mic now.
Hello. My name is Mitchell Stepanchuk. I'm involved with a number of media activists and media producing organizations in Chicago. And the point that was just raised with regards to the FCC's media ownership rules kind of leads me to my question. I've got a fairly lengthy setup and then a question mainly focused towards Mr. Swanson, but if other people want to chime in, please do. It's this. In Chicago, the main media monopoly there, probably unquestionably, is the Tribune Company. One of the FCC rules at play was called the cross-ownership rule. No company can own a single TV station and a single newspaper in the same market. Now, the Tribune Company, as I speak here now, in New York City, in Los Angeles, in South Florida, and in Hartford, Connecticut, the Tribune Company owns newspapers and TV stations in all of those markets in blatant violation of the law. The Tribune Company, in opposition to this, first bought these arrangements, then lobbied like mad to try to change the rules. Then when it turns out that they couldn't, because of a mass movement that had arisen, an emergency court order, a successful lawsuit, and just last month, a judge in Connecticut ordered the Tribune Company to divest one of their TV stations in Connecticut. Now, the reason I mention all this, that's the lengthy setup. My question is, and it kind of goes to Mr. Swanson's speech, you have this paradox that I'm reading here. On the one hand, you've got all of these major media interests that tout their concern to community and to corporate conscience. And on the other hand, you've got a very bad example of a company openly breaking the law on these issues. My question is, how do you resolve that paradox?
Well, you've picked an example in Chicago. It's one that we compete against. The Tribune there owns—you're absolutely right—owns the Tribune, the paper, owns Channel 9, WGN Television, owns the radio station. They actually own the Cubs. It hadn't helped them there, but that would appear to be a clear violation of the ownership rules. I was at ABC when Cap Cities bought the company, and Cap Cities divested itself of its New Haven television station, its Buffalo television station, and I actually sold the ABC station in Detroit to Scripps Howard because what Cap Cities wanted to do was keep PVI at the time, and that overlapped with WABC in New York. And they needed to get a waiver, so they divested themselves. So part of our arrangement in buying the Sacramento television station is we were required to divest ourselves of a radio station in Sacramento, which we are in the process of doing. So, and you're absolutely right, because I live in Connecticut. The Tribune has been ordered by the court there to divest itself of some of its media interest in Hartford, although they will appeal it, obviously. You can find examples of Fox in New York. They own the New York Post, and they own two television stations. So
I'm sorry, I've been told to that we are running out of time. The
reality is that there are violations of the ownership rules in which some of it has been grandfathered for one reason or another.
Okay. But a quick clue on this. Go read the Tribune annual report, and I bet you will find that they have assurances to their stockholders that the Tribune Corporation will be able to use license appeals and federal court action to delay any divestiture for at least 5 years. They're playing the game.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut it off now, and I'm going to have to apologize to everybody who patiently stood in line. Maybe you can ask the panelists questions in person, and we're going to take a brief break and reconvene for the next panel. Thank you very much.